From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, the famous children's book author who explores the adventures and the terrors of childhood in his picture books. We feature an interview with Maurice Sendak. His books include Where the Wild Things Are, In the Night Kitchen, and Outside Over There. Also, we talk with Dr. David Spiegel about living as well as you can while faced with the limits imposed by serious illness. Dr. Spiegel is a psychiatrist who has conducted groundbreaking research which reinforces the theory that a terminally ill patient's attitude can affect his or her prognosis. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Bozell. President Clinton plans to include a stop in Syria on his itinerary when he visits the Middle East next week. He explained why during a news conference at the White House this afternoon.
I will visit Syria because it is my judgment that the visit will further the goal of an ultimate peace agreement between Israel and Syria. And until that is done, we will never have comprehensive peace in the Middle East.
Negotiations between Israel and Syria opened nearly 3 years ago. The two countries are still divided over the future of the Golan Heights. On another foreign policy matter, the president welcomed Prime Minister John Major's announcement today that the British government will begin talks with the political arm of the Irish Republican Army, which has declared a ceasefire in its battle to get British troops out of Northern Ireland.
Let me first, congratulate the action which was taken and Prime Minister Major's response to it. I think both are very hopeful. And I am very glad that the United States has been able to be involved in this peace process in Northern Ireland. We will continue to be involved in it, and we certainly want to contribute to the development of Northern Ireland in ways that go beyond even what we've done already with the Irish American Fund.
Major says those talks could begin by the end of the year. President Clinton also commented on the agreement signed today in Geneva between the U.S. and North Korea. He called it a good deal for the U.S., saying North Korea has agreed to freeze its nuclear program. The president said that will make South Korea more secure. A federal judge has sentenced Rosario Ames, wife of confessed spy Aldrich Ames, to slightly more than 5 years in prison. NPR's Christopher Joyce reports.
The 63-month sentence for Rosario Ames is the minimum term proposed in a plea bargain worked out by her lawyers and federal prosecutors. Rosario Ames and her husband Aldrich, a career officer at the Central Intelligence Agency, pled guilty last April to espionage. Aldrich Ames had been selling information to the Soviet KGB for years before the CIA caught on. Aldrich Ames is now serving a life sentence. In court today, Rosario Ames begged for mercy, telling the judge she needed to be with her 5-year-old son, now living with relatives. Prosecutors say Rosario Ames actively collaborated in her husband's espionage. The breach of security is considered the worst ever for the CIA and is believed to have cost the lives of at least 10 foreigners working for U.S. intelligence agencies. I'm Christopher Joyce reporting.
Superior Court Judge Lance Ito has changed his mind and decided to allow the public and media into the courtroom as jury selection continues in the O.J. Simpson trial. A spokesman says Ito changed his mind at the request of Simpson's attorneys. They had asked for the ban but then said it was too extreme and they had made a mistake in seeking it. On Wall Street, the Dow Industrials are down 22.5 points in heavy trading. This is NPR News. Academy Award-winning actor Burt Lancaster has died at his home in Los Angeles after a long illness. Lancaster's career in movies covered 5 decades. He starred in more than 70 films, including such classics as From Here to Eternity, Elmer Gantry, and The Birdman of Alcatraz. Burt Lancaster was 80. The Department of Energy says it intends to build a huge facility where giant lasers will set off nuclear fusion reactions. The facility is expected to cost nearly $2 billion, and Congress still has to approve money for the project. NPR's Dan Charles reports.
The new machine would set off nuclear fusion by focusing sudden, powerful laser bursts on a small pellet of fuel, usually a form of hydrogen. The Department of Energy already has a machine like this at its nuclear weapons laboratory in Livermore, California. But the new project would be 10 times as powerful. It would be the most powerful collection of lasers in the world. DOE officials say the new project could be used in scientific research and perhaps as a step toward a commercial power plant using nuclear fusion. But it also has a military purpose. Scientists can use it to simulate small nuclear explosions. And critics of the project say it could undercut U.S. efforts to convince other countries to stop testing nuclear weapons. This is Dan Charles in Washington.
No comment today from former Virginia Governor Douglas Wilder to reports that he plans to endorse longtime political rival Senator Charles Robb tonight. Robb, a Democrat, is locked in a tight race with Republican challenger Oliver North. Washington-based news media report Wilder plans to endorse Robb during a show of unity with President Clinton at a fundraiser tonight. At least five people were killed today in a fire near Bloomsburg University in Pennsylvania. Fire investigators say the blaze started in a sofa on the porch of a home near the Pennsylvania school. I'm Ann Bozell, NPR News in Washington.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On this archive edition of Fresh Air, we present one of our favorite recent interviews with a guest who I know has a special place in the hearts of many adults and their children. For decades, Maurice Sendak has been one of America's most popular writers and illustrators of children's books. His best-known books include Where the Wild Things Are, In the Night Kitchen, and Outside Over There. Sendak takes an unsentimental view of childhood. In fact, many of his books are about children's fears. When I spoke with him in September of 93, I asked what frightened him as a child.
When I was young, the big events were being sick and being expected to die, and knowing that at a very early age, I might. This was spoken. My parents were very indiscreet. My parents came from a foreign country. They were immigrants. They didn't know about Freud. They didn't know about what to say or not to say in front of children. And they loved us, me, my brother, and my sister, but that I suffered a good deal from very severe illnesses, not untypical of 30s children when there were no sulfa drugs and there wasn't penicillin. And you went through all the dire illnesses, and sometimes you just croaked. So it was the awareness at a very early age of mortality which pervaded my soul, apparently, and I think provided me with the basic ingredients of being an artist. That was critical. And knowing that I was vulnerable and that other children were vulnerable.
What did you have? What
diseases? Scarlet fever and pneumonia twice and whooping cough and chicken pox. It was the pneumonia and the scarlet fever that really nearly did me in.
Were you carefully watched over by your parents
while
you were sick?
I was so carefully watched over. They practically killed me with watching over me. So I was delicate. I was very delicate.
In those days when you were sick and everybody was worried about you dying, did you have any sense of what death was?
I don't remember that. But I do remember I was a very close companion to death. And I remember a game my father played with me, which you would not exactly call a death game, but did move in that direction, which was that if I lay in bed, which I spent a lot of time doing, and I remember in one particular place we lived in Brooklyn, we moved quite frequently because of financial problems, and just opposite the foot of my bed was a window looking out in the backyard facing a just very boring brick wall. And he said, if you looked and didn't blink, if you saw an angel, you'd be a very, very lucky child. And so I did that frequently. And of course, I would always blink because it hurt not to blink. And then you didn't see it. And he'd say, well, you blinked, didn't you? And I say, yes. And I remember once I didn't blink and I saw it. Or I imagined I saw it. But the memory of it is so vivid, I could even describe it to you.
Would you?
Well, I was lying in the bed, obviously, staring out the window, my eyelids aching, my eyes aching. Staring, and something very large, like almost like a dirigible. But it wasn't a dirigible because it was right past my window. It was a slow-moving angel. She, he, whatever, moved very gracefully and slowly, coming from left, going across to right, not turning to observe me at all. I don't have a memory of the face, but I remember a memory of the hair, the body and the wings. I was it took my breath away. It just moved so slowly that I could examine it quite minutely. And then I shrieked and hollered, and my father came in, and I said, I saw it. And he said, I was a very lucky kid.
So when you saw the angel, did you think that that was a sign that you were going to live or that something wonderful was going to happen?
I think it put me in alliance with death things, with important things. I can't really describe it. I really can't tell you what it meant. It's a very internal feeling, but it came out of such a complex awareness as a child of the fragility of life. There is a story which I can't prove, but I was told that at a very early age, my parents dressed me. It's a religious custom or superstition from the old country. They dressed me all in white from top to toe so that if God is watching, he would have thought me already an angel and he would not pluck me. And I wouldn't die, in other words. I would be a fraudulent angel. This is a superstition, and it does occur in old villages in the old country. I don't know that it happened to me. But it's significant that it was a family story, so that it told me how forcefully they were concerned about me.
Did you see your parents as being really capable parents who could help fend off death or fend off whatever other problems that you had?
No, because they were so vulnerable to problems. They caved in on problems all the time. So I did not see them. And this is not a criticism of them. Their lives were extremely hard. But no, I did not see them that way.
Now, they were from Poland?
They were from Poland, yeah.
And they fled before World War I?
Yes, they did. Just before World War I. They didn't flee. My father left on a lark.
Oh, well, what was that?
He had no cause to come here. My grandfather was a rabbi. He was the youngest son, and he was obviously the spoiled younger son of my grandmother. And he actually fell in love with a young woman. And it became a little bit scandalous, and she was put on a boat and shipped off to America. And he sulked and pouted and got money out of his siblings and got on another boat to follow her here. And his family was appalled at his behavior. Because of that trivial behavior, he was the only survivor of his entire family. I mean, all of my uncles and aunts and all of the children were destroyed in concentration camps. My father's grief for his entire life was that his survival was based on such a trivial impulse. It really did cause him a lot of grief, especially when he became older.
Did your parents talk to you much about the old country?
Oh, yeah. Thank goodness. And when my father was last year of his life, paradoxically, we had a wonderful time, I took his biography down, which was wonderful. A lot of it was fantasy and a lot of it was reality, but I was...
His biography?
Yeah.
He wrote a biography?
He wrote a biography, which is not published. He did write a fairy tale, which I translated with the help of somebody else and illustrated, and that was published just before his death.
Right.
It's called In Grandpa's House. But his biography is not published, and I don't intend to have it published. It's a private family chronicle. We didn't get much of my mother's life. My mother was silent about that period of her life.
I think as a lot of people from Eastern Europe who came to America were. Did they seem like aliens to you because, I don't know, did they speak more Yiddish than English?
Yes, they spoke more Yiddish. I spoke Yiddish as a child. My parents spoke English very, very late and very poorly. And we lived in a part of Brooklyn which was teeming with immigrants, either other people from Eastern Europe, Jews, or Sicilians. And I couldn't tell the difference. I mean, we lived next to the Sicilians, and I had a real, it sounds like coy conceit, but it's a fact. I had a real confusion because right across the hall from us was my best friend at one place we lived, Carmine, and his sisters and brothers and his huge mother and huge father, just across the hall. And I used to run across the hall because they had unkosher food, which is much better, much better than kosher food because it was pasta. It was great Italian cooking. And they laughed, and they drank wine, and they grabbed me, and I sat in their laps, and they had a hell of a good time. Then you come back to my house, and you have these sober cuisine and not so rambunctious family life. And I really did have a confusion that Italians were happy Jews, that they were a sect.
That's and really
that,
interesting.
And that I would have a choice. That I would have a choice after my bar mitzvah to belong to either the sober sect or the happy sect.
And they went to a different synagogue where they had pasta.
Yeah, I was a dumb kid, let me tell you. I mean, all the parents looked alike. They all wore the same dull black dresses, and you couldn't tell the difference. Not to me.
My guess is the artist and writer Maurice Sendak. One of the great controversies about your book, is, you know, in the night kitchen, when the character Mickey lands in the batter, he's naked, and mm-hmm. there's this, like, little boy penis that he has, right? Yeah. And there were libraries that wouldn't carry the book or would draw little diapers over him, all kinds of silly things like that. I mean, this was not a sexual image. It was just a naked boy image.
Correct.
Right?
I mean, it would have been strange had he not had a penis.
Right.
But no one has ever discussed that problem.
Right.
The astonishing and infuriating business on that book was it's one of my favorite works, and it's a rather complex work. And to have it all reduced, so to speak, to a child's penis is embarrassing and silly. And the fact that anyone could carry on about such an issue, does not speak well for our culture.
Well, here's what I'm wondering. Now, that book was not about Mickey as a sexual boy or anything, but I think a lot of kids do have sexual feelings, maybe just a little bit older than Mickey. And I was wondering if you ever thought about putting sexual feelings into a children's book, or if that would seem like much too far out.
Well, I have to correct something you say, or at least I don't agree with something you just said, which is that he, little boy in the night kitchen, does not have sexual feelings. Of course he does. We have them immediately on arrival. We may have them in utero. I suspect we probably do, but we just haven't traced that yet. There's nothing, in a word, that you can do that is not sexual, so far as I'm concerned. And the creative act is composed of its sexual component. As animals, which is all that we are, obviously, there's nothing we can do that isn't sexual, thank God. And I don't mean by saying sexual, that is vivid, livid sex. I mean the component of sexuality, sensuality, eroticism is part of everything. And it's what blesses our life. And instead of seeing it in an accusatory way, and I don't mean you, I mean culture in general, or blameworthy way, rather see it for the beautiful thing that it is. We can't do without it.
I remember I interviewed you, 8 years ago or something. Something that you said really stuck with me. You were talking about the monsters and where the wild things are, and you were saying that when you were young, the monsters were just adults. There were people with, like, moles on their faces and hairs growing out of their noses.
Yeah.
All
relatives,
actually. Yeah, old relatives, exactly. Relative, exactly. Yeah. And that really struck a chord. And then I started thinking, well, I'm one of those people now. I mean, I don't know if I actually have hair growing out of my nose, but you know, I have some of those things that I'm sure kind of like scare kids.
Oh, sure.
And do you have your sense of yourself as that too?
Of
like,
course.
You know, a monster to some kids?
Of course I am. I see it in their eyes. When I'm autographing books, which I don't like to do much anymore, and children are shoved at me.
Yeah.
They have no idea why they're on the line. They'd much rather be in the bathroom. And they're standing in line, and they're being told something which is so frightening and confusing, which is being told by mom or dad. This is the man you like so much, honey. This is the man who did your favorite book. And they clutch their book even closer, because that really means he's going to take it away. Because if this is the man's favorite book, then he's going to take your book. And the look of alarm and the tears, and they stare at me like pure hatred. Who is this elderly, short man sitting behind the desk who's going to take their book away? Then on top of that, the parent says, "Now give him your book, honey. He wants to write something in it." Well, there they've been told, don't write in a book. Okay? Why then is it all right for a perfect stranger to write in their book? It's horrible for them. And I become horrible unwittingly. I make children cry.
They cry when
they cry when they meet me, because they don't know what I'm doing. And only when they're, it's quicker with girls, because girls are smarter than boys. We all know that. They grow up faster. And girls, by the time they're 7 or 8, already know the business of autographing and what it means. Boys don't till they're about 40, I think. And so they'll pull it away. There's only one child who ever had the courage, and his father was urging him forward. I could see the hesitation. I just felt so bad for the kid, and I put my hand on the book to help draw it away from him, and he literally screamed and said, "Don't crap up my book." It was the bravest cry I've ever heard. I nearly wept.
So what'd you do?
Well, I took the father aside because I think the father was going to kill the kid because he'd embarrassed him and made everybody laugh. And I had to sit down and say how great I thought his kid was and not to be angry with him because the child just didn't understand what this whole nonsense, this social nonsense of autographing was all about. And it would be criminal to punish him for this.
This is great. Every time you do a book signing, it's kind of like dysfunctional family America.
That's right. It comes into psychiatric sessions.
You must feel awful, though. You know, because you're being misunderstood by the kids who love your books.
Well, frankly, that's why I do not visit children in classrooms.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I've stopped autographing for the most part. Uh-huh. For that very, very reason, it's such a paradox that I, who adore them and I'm interested in their welfare, should become their enemy. It's only because it's set up that way. If I'm to visit a school, they're all warned, threatened, and browbeaten for 3 days before I get there. Now I want all of you to be nice, and you must raise your hand, and I want everyone to go to the bathroom before Mr. Sendak comes. I mean, their lives are ruined. So why should I be the person who does that to them?
Marie Sendak recorded in September of 1993. Sendak is the author and illustrator of many children's books, including Where the Wild Things Are and In the Night Kitchen. This is Fresh Air. So many of us grew up with Maurice Sendak's books, and many of us have given his books to the children in our lives. It was a great pleasure to interview an artist who's helped shape the imagination of so many Americans. Books that are widely read are part of what hold us together as Americans. They're something we have in common. I think of public radio as having that function, too. Public radio is something we share, a place where Americans talk to each other, a place to hear about the experiences of Americans from many different backgrounds. There's another level of sharing that is very important during this National Fundraising Week. I hope you'll share your financial support by calling your station with a pledge. Thank you so much. In music, as in most areas of our culture, success breeds imitation. In the post-war era, many young black singers tried to emulate the success of black vocalists like Nat King Cole and Louis Jordan. For the most part, the result sounded pretty generic. But rock and roll historian Ed Ward says one record producer spotted a great talent among the imitators.
In 1935, a terrible 1-2 punch of tragedy hit Aretha Robinson, a young black woman who lived in Greensville, Florida. She had two sons, Ray, who was 5, and George, a year younger, and her husband was an itinerant railroad worker, so she had to raise them by herself. Fortunately, both kids were extraordinarily smart, especially George, who was a self-taught mathematical whiz. But one afternoon, George decided to go for a swim in a tub Aretha kept for rinsing the laundry she took in, and although he'd swum in it many times before, this time he drowned. Before the small family could recover from the shock, Ray discovered that a thick substance was coating his eyes, and a local doctor confirmed their worst fears. He was going blind. 2 years later, he was blind. He would have to attend a school for blind black children, and Aretha knew what that meant. He would be taught to beg or to make brooms. But Ray had an ace in the hole. He'd started playing the piano at the corner store. Before he left for school, she counseled him to stay away from the guitar they might try to teach him and concentrate on the piano. He followed her advice, and it's a good thing he did.
A sentimental blues will worry you and make you do things that you wouldn't do only when you hear these blues.
He was an excellent piano player, and his singing voice wasn't bad either. A young record distributor, Henry Stone, heard him singing in a nightclub one evening and brought him to the attention of a man named Jack Lauderdale, who owned Swing Time, a record label that specialized in sophisticated blues singers. Lauderdale liked what he heard and took Ray and his band, the Maxim Trio, into the studio to cut a bunch of records, including this one.
Thank you.
have a soul to care. If you're feeling low down, you don't have a soul to care. Just grab your hat and start for the rocking chair.
Songs like Rockin' Chair Blues were all very nice, and in the backwoods honky-tonks that the Maxim Trio played, they must have been the height of sophistication. But Lauderdale saw right off that there were problems. One was that the band wasn't good enough for the piano player, and the other was that the piano player sounded just like Charles Brown, who, along with Nat King Cole, was the hottest black singer of the day. Oh, and his name, Ray Robinson, was getting him confused with the boxer who was getting so much publicity, Sugar Ray Robinson. His middle name would have to do for a last name, at least on stage, so Lauderdale's new star put out his next batch of records under his new name, Ray Charles.
Now don't put all your dreams in one basket. Don't put all your hope in one heart. For if you discover that she loves another, you'll be licked before you start.
And another thing, the kid thought he was good on these syrupy ballads, but he was sure no Nat Cole. The trouble was, funkier material didn't sell, except in the South, and Swing Time was looking for a national share of the growing black record market. The only people who liked the down-home stuff in the North were jazz buffs, record collectors like the two sons of the Turkish ambassador to the U.S., Ahmet and Neshwi Erdogan. They had a little record label of their own, Atlantic. Ahmet, in particular, seemed to be everywhere, and he'd heard of Ray Charles.
Down in St. Pete, Florida, how about my baby? Be there. Ooh, St. Pete, St. Pete, Florida. How about my baby there? No one's ever loved me like my baby. Any place, anywhere.
Songs like St. Pete, Florida, recorded live at a party, showed that Ray Charles had another voice, one Ahmet was itching to combine with an up-to-date jazz backup. But was Lauderdale going to let loose of his only star? The answer was yes. Lauderdale was almost broke, and he sold Ray's contract for $2,500.
The midnight hour have found me lonely, so unhappy as I can be.
At first, Ray insisted on singing in his old style, but they kept after him, and early in 1953, they made the breakthrough that launched a poor blind piano player from Florida and America's top rhythm and blues label simultaneously. Both Ray Charles and Atlantic Records had found their direction.
You can talk about the pit, barbecue. The band was jumping, the people too. I mess around. They're doing the mess around. They're doing the mess around. Everybody doing the mess around. Everybody was juiced. You can bet your soul. They did the boogie woogie with a sturdy roll. They mess around. They're doing the mess around.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. This is Fresh Air.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. When faced with a terminal illness, can non-medical factors, like the patient's attitude, change a prognosis? Coming up on this archive edition, we feature an interview with Dr. David Spiegel. In a groundbreaking study, he found that women with breast cancer lived longer if they were part of a support group. Dr. Spiegel is critical of modern medicine for focusing on the disease, not the person with it. But he also criticizes alternative medicine for believing you can wish away an illness. His book, Living Beyond Limits, has just been published in paperback. That's coming up on Fresh Air.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Dr. David Spiegel is a psychiatrist who works with people who have life-threatening illnesses. He says he's found that the best way to face the threat of serious illness is to look it right in the eye, to face the worst, rather than simply hoping for the best. He's a professor of psychiatry at the Stanford University School of Medicine, where he's been studying the connection between the body and the mind. He's conducted a landmark study on the value of support groups for women with metastasized breast cancer. Perhaps you saw the documentary on his work, which was featured on the Bill Moyers series, Healing in the Mind. Dr. Spiegel is the author of a book about facing life-threatening illness called Living Beyond Limits. It's just been published in paperback. Dr. Spiegel is critical of how both modern medicine and alternative medicine deal with illness.
I think the problem with modern medicine is what I like to think of as mindless materialism. The model in modern medicine is that the body is a machine like a car, and that if something goes wrong, you just replace the part. And we're so focused on high-tech intervention and on what I think of as the myth of cure. We really have, rather than a healthcare system, a disease cure system, in which the whole focus of medical intervention is thought to be curing illness, when the fact is that most Americans live with and die of chronic illnesses like heart disease, cancer, and stroke. And what people need from their doctors is caring, is learning how to live with these serious illnesses. So while certainly we should go for a cure whenever it's possible, I think we've lost sight of the oldest tradition of medicine, which is to cure rarely, to relieve suffering often, and to comfort always. And I think we've got it backwards, and we need to get back on the old track of what medicine is all about.
Now, you've said that you started your support group study expecting to prove that there wasn't a connection between survival and positive thinking. Why did you expect that you would find no connection, especially as a psychiatrist? Why did you expect that that connection wouldn't exist?
Well, being a psychiatrist teaches you modesty, and you learn that there are tough problems that you come up against. And I, knowing what I know about cancer and its progression, I thought that we could help people live better with it, that we could help reduce their anxiety and depression and even help them control pain. But I was not prepared for the evidence that we found that enhancing social support and coping with disease might have an effect on the rate of progression. I'm interested in the problem, but the effect we found was just far stronger than anything I would have guessed at the beginning.
Share with us what the results were.
Well, we had 86 women who were assigned by what we call a randomization, in which you allow the toss of a coin or a computer to select who gets a year of weekly support group interventions and who gets just routine, standard, excellent medical oncology care. And we found after the initial year that the women who got the intervention, that was 50 of the 86, were less anxious and depressed and had half the pain. But what was much more surprising was that by the end of 4 years, all of the control group had died and a third of the treatment sample were still alive. And the average survival time for the intervention sample was 18 months longer than that in the control group.
Can you interpret the results? Why do you think it is so that women with breast cancer who were in a support group lived longer than their counterparts who didn't have that support group?
Well, there, you know, it seems almost mystical, but there are a number of studies that show that social integration is a powerful variable in mortality. This was reviewed in Science several years ago by James House. And in general, the relative risk of dying if you're socially isolated is elevated as much as if you had high serum cholesterol or smoked. It's a powerful relationship, and yet we ignore it and pay little attention to it. I think there are four possible mechanisms that could account for what we observed with breast cancer patients. The first is what I like to think of as the grandmother effect. Perhaps people who are less anxious and depressed and are coping with their disease better do all the things your grandmother told you to do. Eat well, sleep well, and get plenty of exercise. So it may be sort of the body maintenance things that these people do better. The second possibility is that they make better use of their health care, that they get diagnostic tests when they need them, that they adhere better to treatment regimens, and get more vigorous treatment. They may elicit more vigorous treatment. You know, the doctor sees a woman who has lots to live for, has a book she wants to write or a project she wants to do, and figures, okay, we'll go that extra mile and give the next round of chemotherapy. So that's a second possibility. The third involves the endocrine system. Stress causes our body to release hormones like cortisol and prolactin in higher amounts. And these hormones have been shown to stimulate the growth of tumor cells, particularly breast cancer. That's why we often use estrogen receptor blockers like tamoxifen and Megase to slow the progression of cancer. So it is possible that if you handle stress better and if social support acts like a stress buffer, you may be reducing your own body's tendency to stimulate the growth of the tumor that's in it. And the fourth possible mechanism involves the immune system. We now know that the nervous system and the immune system talk to each other, that white blood cells that attack cancer cells respond to neurotransmitters, the chemicals that one nerve secretes to stimulate another nerve to action. We also know that cytokines, which are secreted by the white blood cells involved in the immune system, affect the central nervous system, and that stress can reduce the functioning of certain parts of the immune system, can increase vulnerabilities to infection, and that social support can buffer that block. So it's possible that in some way being a part of the group helped these women's immune systems function better.
I want to make it clear that you're not saying that positive thinking alone is going to help you a lot. You say denial and overly optimistic attitudes are not helpful.
Terry, that's absolutely right. I'm a proponent of realistic thinking, not positive thinking. In fact, the women in our group call that alternative point of view the prison of positive thinking. And an example is some woman started to cry and her husband said, "Stop crying, you'll make the cancer spread." Who needs that? What we try to do is help people realistically face what's ahead of them. And that means face the disease and its treatment, the fact that it may well shorten their lives, and live as well as you can in the face of that knowledge. So that means at times you won't be positive at all. You'll be sad, you'll be upset, you'll be frightened. But the interesting thing that I've seen time and again over the 15 years we've run these groups is that shortly after we're there crying about how terrifying this illness is and what it means, we'll be laughing about something else. And what you do is you free people to feel negative feelings and to feel positive feelings, to see the joy as well as the tragedy in life.
How does the support group experience compare to the typical conversations the women in the support group were able to have with their own families?
Well, you know, it depends a lot on how open the families are. But what we found is that there is a kind of intensity about the support groups that many women say is quite different from what they can usually do with their families. They know it's a place where they're going to deal with their worst fears, and it becomes a time and a place to, as one woman put it, feel better about feeling bad. They're with other people who know what they're going through. And so at times it's easier for them to share their fear, their sadness, their frustration, their anger with other women who are in the same boat than it is with family who have their own problems to deal with it as well.
Dr. David Spiegel is my guest, and his new book, Living Beyond Limits, is about facing life-threatening illness and the advantages of having a support group when you're facing it. I saw the Bill Moyers program about your support group, and one of the moments that I found really, really moving was when the daughter of one of the women in the group came and spoke with you, and mm-hmm. she was weeping, the daughter, and she said that, you know, her mother was the person who had the most faith in her. She'd had a lot of failures, but her mother always believed that she'd do fine, and she felt that when she lost her mother, she'd be losing her greatest friend and her greatest ally.
Yeah.
But she didn't feel like she could talk like this to her mother because she thought that her mother would fall to pieces if she heard this and that they'd just both weep uncontrollably and it would be miserable. What advice did you give her?
Well, Now, I've never lost anybody in terminal weeping, and I advised her very strongly to have that talk with her mother. Now, and this was an unusual situation, in that fortunately her mother watched the Bill Moyers show, too, so she got, got the message. But one of the touching things in that meeting, actually, the best advice came from the mother of a woman who was dying, and she said to her daughter, "You're my best friend." They both started to cry, and the daughter said, I knew that, but it means so much more that you've told me that. And I think there are a lot of things that we take for granted, that of course they know that, and we don't bother telling people, and they're the most important things in life. And the proximity of death, if it's handled right, can get you to say those things that you want to be sure the person knows before they die.
You make the point in your book that hope for a cure is just one kind of hope. What are the other kinds of hope that you think, for instance, a support group can offer?
Support groups can offer hope that if you can't be cured, that you can live a very interesting, productive, worthwhile life during the time that you're coping with the progression of the illness. So it's a kind of realistic hope. It's not the false hope that life will be the way it was before this all happened, which is what everybody understandably wants, but many cannot have. But it's a different kind of hope. They can watch somebody who, we had one woman in the group who'd been a frustrated poet all of her life, and before she died, she had written two small, very fine books of poetry. I quote some of her poems in Living Beyond Limits. And so they can see that life isn't over, that it may not go on, you may not die when you're 95 in your sleep, but there's a lot of interesting, worthwhile things that you can do, and you know it's true because you see other people in the same boat as yours who are doing it. So I think it provides a kind of realistic hope in which people kind of redefine the horizons of their life, what the dimensions of it are, but then say, okay, given that, what can I do that I want to do with my life now?
Do you talk about this a lot with the people in the group, the responsibility of the dying to the living?
You bet. That's a major issue. And some lovely things have come of it. I just attended a memorial service for a woman who died several weeks ago. And she sat down and wrote a letter to her 4-year-old that was read at the service, in which she talked about how she had been reluctant to play the piano because she didn't do it perfectly, and she set very high standards to herself. But one day she did, and she turned around and noticed that her 4-year-old was dancing to the music. And she said, "You gave me a gift because I realized I was playing just fine, if you could enjoy it that much." And that's a legacy for her daughter. And this is something where she was giving a gift to her daughter that is of tremendous importance.
I want to, I don't know exactly what my question is here, but it has to do with acceptance versus anger. When something happens to you very sudden, you know, like suddenly finding out about an illness, your life has changed and suddenly there's this big line, this big before and after line, mm-hmm. and nothing after will ever be quite the same.
That's right.
And so you could get really angry about it, or you could try to work yourself into this state of acceptance about it, hoping that eventually you will accept it. And you know, I sometimes can't tell which is better. I mean, it seems like anger is really justified, although maybe pointless. And you don't, you know, maybe acceptance too soon is either kidding yourself or giving in when maybe it's better to fight.
Well, I think you're right, Terry. You know, in a sense, you don't control your feelings. You control what you do about them. You control what you think and how you cope. But your feelings happen to you. And I think there's something sometimes phony or unduly constraining about saying, well, you know, I'm supposed to be past this stage now, so I won't be angry. I'll be
right, there's
this.
The 4 stages of how one copes, blah,
right,
blah.
Right,
yeah.
And people aren't like that. And so what I'm saying is just give yourself room to feel what you feel.
Right.
Now, just because you're angry doesn't mean you go out and do all kinds of crazy things about it. But if you feel that way, feel it. That's okay. And what I find is that people shift from state to state. So for a while, they'll be mad as hell, and then they'll somehow find that they're just not as angry about it as they used to be. But then maybe 2 months later, they will be again, and that's okay. It's a matter of giving yourself permission to feel whatever it is you feel about it.
You write that serious illness is not a good thing, but good things can come out of it. I hate hearing that kind of statement from somebody who's a real Pollyanna, but you're not.
Mm-hmm.
So tell me what you mean when you say good things can come of it.
Well, it can. What I mean is, I don't think anybody wishes it on themselves. I think it's a terrible mistake to tell people that they needed their illness and that's why they got it. That's nonsense. But what I am saying is this, that if the illness becomes an occasion for you to take stock of your life and get rid of some things that have been, in retrospect, mistakes, and commit yourself to new things, to tell people you care about how much you care about them, to do things you've been putting off but need doing. It doesn't mean that the illness is good, but it means you can make something good of it. If you can use your experience of coping with cancer to help somebody else get through it better, that is a genuinely good thing that you're doing for someone else that came out of something that's a tragedy. But you know what? A lot of human life is like that. You know, we have to live with tragedy. It's a part of life. And the best things we do in the human condition are making something decent out of those tragedies.
Dr. David Spiegel is a professor of psychiatry at the Stanford University School of Medicine. His book, Living Beyond Limits, has just been published in paperback. Our interview was recorded 1 year ago. This is Fresh Air. You know, all that we have on an interview program like Fresh Air is words. That's why we value someone like Dr. David Spiegel, who's so eloquent in expressing his thoughts on illness and death, subjects that most of us have tremendous difficulty even discussing. I find that when a guest expresses emotionally complex thoughts with clarity, it's like a gift, because it's given me a way to think about the subject more clearly. I hope you find that too, and I hope you think that this program and all the programs you value on public radio are worthy of your financial support. Without the support of Fresh Air fans, your station wouldn't be able to carry the program. Please call with a pledge. Thank you. On this archive edition of our show, we have a performance she recorded in our studio in 1989. The first song she played is Red Hot.
1, 2, 3, 4. Oh, baby, I'm a red hot. Yes, baby, I'm a red hot. Oh, honey, I can't stop. I can't stop thinking about you. My temperature just ain't the same since I felt your burning flame. I'm a red hot. Yeah, honey, I'm a red hot. I can't stop thinking about you. First time I saw you walk by, I went off like a rocket on the 4th of July. Yes, baby, I'm a red hot. Oh, honey, I'm a red hot. I can't stop thinking about you. Don't you go and dial that 911 number for me. I'm just like a house on fire. Your love is what I need. Oh, baby, I'm red hot. Yes, baby, I'm red hot. Oh, honey, I can't stop. I can't stop thinking about you. Oh, yeah, babe.
I think if you grow up in Louisiana, you have more than the typical percentage of water in your chemical makeup. And as a result, you're drawn to water. And this next song happened because I was following the water, as I always do, along the Gulf Coast, and happened to be in Mobile, standing on that beautiful bay one day. And I thought, how long has it been since somebody wrote a song about this place? And so I wrote this song called Mobile.
Well, I found myself in a cold, cold city, looking out the windows of a bar. I had the snow piled up on the sidewalk and the big streets full of cars. I wonder what happened to this old girl, what mysterious turning of the wheel. So far from Mobile, Mobile, by the beautiful bay, Mobile, why did I ever go away? Oh, how I miss my Alabama home. It's a far cry from this place, but I followed a man. He had promises grand and a very handsome face. I left my loving husband behind. I thought life owed me more. Well, how I regret taking that first step away from my front door in Mobile by the beautiful bay. Mobile, why did I ever go away?
Marsha Ball, recorded in our studio in 1989. Marsha Ball has a new CD on Rounder Records called Blue House. I'm Terry Gross.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Planet of the Ants. E.O. Wilson is an expert on ants. He's identified 9,000 species. He says studying them is like studying creatures from another planet. Also, we talk with actor Brian Benben, star of the HBO series Dream On and the new movie The Radioland Murders. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.
Yeah.